Hello and welcome to Outside In. I'm John Burns and this is my podcast for folk who'd rather be outside but are compelled for obvious reasons to be remaining inside. To be quite honest, the weather up in Inverness here right now is pretty wild and being inside is not a bad idea. It's wet and windy, but let's hope we can get out soon. My guest today is an author who has written a number of books, and one of the books he's written is about the Cairngorms. And Cairngorms got a special place for me. It really are, I think, a special place for many people, really. But I well remember my first introduction to them was one Easter about 40 odd years ago now, a long time ago. But as Easter can be in the Cairngorms, it can either be spring or and lovely and warm, or it can be midwinter. And the Easter I went there was midwinter, and I trekked through the Larry Grew into Caror Bothy, and it was 3 feet of snow, and it left an impression on me of a wild and remote place that's never really left me. So the Cairngorms is certainly a place I love. I'll introduce to you Patrick Baker. Hello, Patrick. How are you?
Hi, John. Good, thanks. Yeah, you okay?
Yes, I'm fine. So you're obviously someone who loves the Cairngorms as well. When did you first get to know the Cairngorms?
Seems like a long time ago now. Actually, it's almost sort of 25 years ago when I first moved to Scotland. And it's one of these places you end up gravitating to even before you know much about Scottish mountaineering. It's one of these places that sort of really resonates and people always talk about. So yeah, much the same thing, I guess, John, for me. I kind of went there and was sort of blown away by the scale of the place and the wildness of it too, you know. And it's I think that's one of the first impressions that a lot of people get. But I suppose for me, I ended up spending more and more time there, and then I was kind of pulled in by a lot of other more kind of nuanced things, more to do with the history and the sort of cultural significance of the Cairngorms, and I suppose that sort of went towards sort of feeding some of the ideas in the Cairngorms book.
And what are the sort of notable places that stick out for you in the Cairngorms then?
Oh gosh, there's so many. I think one of the things that I ended up focusing on when I was writing, and just even before I was writing, actually, was the type of places that I would look for. And it sort of framed in general the way that I sort of go into the outdoors, really. It was not necessarily just heading towards the peaks, but it was going after these kind of strange sort of mythic tales that exist in the Cairngorms, which seem to exist in the Cairngorms in abundance.
Yes.
It's looking for signs of these tales and these sort of folkloric conversations and rumors and myths that you hear. So it's going to find one of those. I suppose one of the most interesting ones was not actually on the plateau itself, but just in Rothie Mercus was a cave that I'd heard about, which was reputedly inhabited for a while by a no good villain by all accounts called Black Sandy, who was a bit of a nasty man and went on the run, and he used this cave which supposedly was called the Cat's Den. And I'd heard of it just through word of mouth, but I'd seen a few sort of oblique references to it in different sort of old pieces of text, and one of the things I wanted to do with that was just to put those pieces of text together to try and triangulate this location and see if I could find it, which I was able to, which was great after a bit of trial and error. So
this Cat's Den, what's the cave like then?
It's ideal if you're a fugitive, I'd say. It's very well hidden. It's high above Loch Annaillin, so you look down on the forest. It's actually a beautiful spot. It's been an incredible place to stay for a while, but it's a very small cave. It's made by boulder falls, so it looks a little bit unstable. So I was quite uncertain sort of going into it, but inside it's sort of spacious enough for one person, and it sort of affords a really beautiful view out across the forestry as well. So very hard to locate, but also if you are a fugitive, looking out for people who are chasing you kind of gives you a good lookout post as well. So I can understand why he picked it.
Sounds a good place. And do many people go there, do you think, this Cave of the Cats, is it? Cat's Den.
Not as far as I'm aware, certainly not. I mean, this is one of the sort of dilemmas, I suppose, of being a writer and writing about somewhere that interests you. You are sort of revealing it to a lot of people, and where it was sort of hitherto a kind of secret location, I guess.
Yeah.
But when I went to look for it quite a few years ago, I couldn't see any signs of any kind of human kind of trails or tracks there.
Right,
I did
right.
find some wildcat prints.
Really?
To be wildcat prints there, very appropriately in the snow.
Yeah.
But there's no visible pathway up to it at all.
Oh right, sounds an amazing place to find then. And tell us, one of the biggest legends of the Cairngorms, obviously, is the legend of the Grey Man, isn't it? What can you tell us about that? What do you know about the legend of the Grey Man?
Yeah, again, that's one of the, I suppose, the most prominent sort of myths for the Cairngorms, and probably the most prominent sort of mountaineering myth in Scotland, if not Britain, I guess.
Yes.
And it's interesting. I sort of touch upon that in the book as well. What's the sort of cultural basis for that myth, and where does it come from? So it's just really exploring some of the topographical reasons, perhaps, why you would get so many references to this ethereal being, because the Big Grey Man, for those who don't know, is supposed to be this sort of disembodied presence which invokes feelings of fear for people who come across it, normally on a misty and kind of overcast and claggy day. And it's supposed to invoke terror in those who've come across it, and sent them running from the hills. So there's a couple of accounts from fairly well respected mountaineers.
Well, was Norman Colley one of them?
It was Norman Colley who's famously recounted his tale. He was renowned for being a little bit of a practical joker, but at the same time, his account seems to be. One of these accounts where it almost sort of fuses this kind of campfire tale with almost what appears to be a sort of real experience. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I think I've read about it once. He was up on Ben McDewey, and I think he got filled with sort of terror that he was being pursued by this huge figure, and he fled from the mountain. But Norman Colley was quite an interesting guy. I mean, he was a scientist as well, wasn't he?
I think he was a physicist, actually, which
that's right. I think this could be bollocks, but I think he invented neon, but I could be wrong, or discovered it or whatever. But I'm not sure if I'm right in saying, but I think he had this experience, but he didn't talk of it for quite a long, quite a number of years, because obviously he didn't want, he thought that revealing this supernatural tale might damage his credibility as a scientist. Is that right, or is that something I've made up?
Yeah, that's exactly what I've heard as well, and he sort of revealed it, as far as I'm aware, for the first time at the 27th annual general meeting of the Cairngorm Club. So, he revealed it in style, I suppose, from keeping it secret to then sort of making it public. He did it in quite a big way, I guess. I've got the quote here, actually. Shall I read it out?
Go ahead. Yeah, that'd be really interesting.
Yeah. So it says, "Every few steps I took, I heard a crunch, then another crunch, as if someone was walking after me, but taking steps three or four times the length of my own. I said to myself, this is all nonsense. I listened and heard it again, but could see nothing in the mist. As I walked on and the eerie crunch, crunch sounded behind me, I was seized with terror and took to my heels, staggering blindly among the boulders for 4 or 5 miles, nearly down to Rothiemurchus Forest. Whatever you make of it, I do not know, but there is something very queer about the top of Ben McDewey, and I will not go back there again by myself, I know."
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
It's quite a dramatic quote. I like it. I like it. It's good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, one of the theories, I mean, one of the theories about the grey man was that it kind of links in. I mean, mountains and huge figures are linked. I mean, you've got obviously the Yeti of the Himalaya, and you've got Canada's Bigfoot, and I think there are other creatures, and there was sort of so maybe there's some link between all these things. I don't know. Maybe we have some sort of primeval need to believe in these giants. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, possibly. One of the things I kind of hypothesize on, I suppose, in the book is that it's maybe to do with the nature of the landscape of that part of the Cairngorms, where they're very flat. Yeah. As you know yourself, John, it's a very indistinguishable place in terms of topography. So yeah. I guess, you know, when you are in a whiteout there, it can be a sort of a real sense of sensory deprivation. So
yeah,
you know, what does our mind then do to fill that sensory gap? So, you know, could that be a possibility that these occurrences have occurred by our minds just playing tricks on us? I'm not sure, but yeah, you're right. There's definitely a sort of link between wild places and some primeval vestigial being of some sort. So yeah, it seems to be a universal theme.
Yeah, certainly. And obviously, your fascination and your interest in mountains has continued. And you have another book coming out tomorrow, The Unremembered Places. Tell us about this book. What inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, so this actually came out last year in hardback, right in the middle of lockdown, which is quite a strange experience. Because
yes.
You know, as you know, as a writer, you kind of, one of the things you look forward to is finishing the book and talking about the book and, you know, meeting people to talk about the book. So there was none of that last year, which is a bit of a shame. But the hardback came out in May last year, and it did pretty well. Yeah, I was really, really pleased with some of the sort of reception that it got. And the paperback is now out tomorrow.
Ah, it's the paperback version. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, the paperback, yeah.
I see. Yeah, yeah. No, I think one of the nice things being an author in the internet age is that you get a chance to talk to your readers, because anybody can track me down on Facebook or Twitter and tell me what a complete mess I made of my last book, you know, which they frequently do. So I think, you know, but that's great, because I think years ago, authors were these I don't know, distant characters living in ivory towers that you couldn't ever contact. But that, all that has been changed by the internet. So yeah, what is it about? Go on, sorry, we're going to say something.
No. So, I was going to say, I actually like, as a sort of avid reader myself, it's nice actually to, you know, just being on Twitter and, you know, sort of interacting with writers as they write. You know, I'm a fan of loads of writers, so it's just nice to sort of there's a lot of bad things about Twitter, but actually there's a lot of sort of good things in terms of just, you know, getting to know more about someone that you admire or are interested in. I think that's
yeah, really, yeah, I think it's a, you know, as you say, the internet gets quite rightly a lot of bad press, but there are some great things about it. In fact, you know, I certainly probably wouldn't have been published if it wasn't for the internet, so you know, it's not bad at all. So tell us about The Unremembered Places. Where did you go to seek those out?
Yeah, so how to summarize the book. So I suppose its aim is to sort of remember some of the things that we've collectively forgotten. So it's a right. series of journeys that I made roughly over sort of the course of 4 years. I'm quite a slow writer. I do all this in my spare time. But to a series of journeys that I made on foot and by paddle to look for some of the what I would consider to be some of the most intriguing but overlooked histories that inhabit some of the more remote landscapes in Scotland, of which there's an abundance, obviously. But I was really looking for, you know, some of the stories that have, or some of these sort of relics and ruins that really have interesting backstories to them that can kind of tell us more about our own sort of cultural identity, I guess, as well. So, you know, from everything from, you know, visiting some of the caves that the early climbers used, to an island off the west coast, which was now uninhabited, called Bel na Huar, but was once the kind of epicenter of the global slate trade, which is fascinating to go there.
Is that right? You know. So it was a really important place regarding the sale of slate. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so it's a small archipelago called the Slate Isles, and Easdale is the island, which is literally just off the coast. But further out, the furthest sort of outlier in the archipelago is Bel na Huar, and it's a tiny right. island that's been. Okay. carved out by the mining industry, so it's got a huge big sea-filled lagoon now in the middle of it.
Oh, right.
And all the workers' cottages, and it's a tiny place, but a huge number of people used to live there. It had no water source, so water had to be carried across, food had to be carried across. I think there were upwards of 100 people, families, living on the island at the time when it was busiest. So it must have been an incredibly busy and industrious place. But when you go now there, it's obviously uninhabited. It's pretty hard to get to, certainly by kayak, which is the way that I travel, just because it's got some really sort of fast tidal runs around the islands there. So yeah, just a really fascinating place, and it, even more so because of what's been left there. You kind of get this sense of you can see the machinery that's still been left there. It's kind of just it's just rusting in situ where it was once used. So it's really really has that sort of sense of halted drama to it, I guess, is one of the,
like, a place that's been just people have just sort of walked away from.
Yeah absolutely. So
I mean, it interests me in it because how can I put it? Well, we often think of places or the places that we see, in particularly in wild places, as being, well, the way they always have been. But, for example, that's not always the case. I mean, I often go to Ardtornish, and it's a wild and beautiful and sort of remote place now, but if you wander into the woods there, you'll find like little circles in the woods, and what they're actually are the remains of charcoal pits, and what once, in a way, that little area was like the focus of Britain's war machine, in a way, because the charcoal that was made there was taken out by boat to Oban, and that's what they made in the cannons that sank the fleet, you know. So it in about 1815. So it was actually a very important place. So it wasn't always quiet. It's just that it's gone, and in the same way in the Cairngorms. I mean, I think certainly Second World War. There was a fair amount of forestry going on in there. Is that right? I think.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, there was the Canadian Corps were there from the First World War actually onwards.
Right, that's it. The Canadians,
and they did a lot of clear felling actually, which is a bit of a shame, especially of the Rothie Murkish Forest.
Yeah,
and on the southern side as well. So yeah, there's, you know, the way, and I suppose that was kind of the point of why I was wanting to write the book, was just to sort of reframe the way that we look at landscapes when we're outdoors, because I think perhaps a lot of people have a tendency to sort of visit places in Scotland in an outdoor sense in a very linear way, I guess, you know, it's about sort of reaching the peak and coming back again.
That's right.
And although I do enjoy that, I'm pretty rubbish at it, so I always get easily distracted. So I quite like this sense of just being in a landscape and being in it slowly and thoughtfully rather than just sort of always.
Yeah, yeah. I think that
target orientated, if you see what I mean.
Well, you know, I spent a lot of my life running up and down hills and not paying too much attention to what I was running through, you know. And I think that I think my life has changed from that point of view. I think there's a tremendous amount of fascination to be found in the glens that we wander through. I mean, I'm interested to see whether you think this is the case. I was talking to a guy called Bob Pegg, and Bob is a great traditional storyteller. Comes from Yorkshire, but he lives in the Highlands. But what he says to me is he feels that a lot of the traditional stories that like the kind of things that you're relating in the Highlands don't have the same links that they did in the places where he lived in Yorkshire. They kind of been lost a lot more, whereas in Yorkshire the tradition of storytelling has kept things alive. And I wondered, this is just me sort of theorizing about it, if the clearances perhaps have contributed to sort of dislocating the people from the heritage of the land that they lived in, because obviously as you'll know, pretty well every glen you walk through will be empty and lonely and probably a place where people shoot deer and not much else. Actually, you'll find ruins of houses where people lived and where they lived their lives. Do you think there's still a cultural hangover from the clearances?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, so from the, roughly, I guess, from about the sort of mid-18th century onwards, you know, you've seen this wholesale depopulation of highland and rural areas and island areas for the clearances for economic reasons. You know, that was augmented by the loss of life from the First World War as well. So there's always these various different factors that have contributed to this sort of just really sort of massive depopulation from areas which would have been, you know, very busy, bustling, lively places. And it's you know, it's very poignant to kind of see that. But in terms of what you're saying, I think there's a loss beyond the sort of immediate physical detachment. I think it's that emotional detachment and, you know, the way that predominantly all of us are now urban dwellers. So, you know, there's this sort of shift towards from rural to urban migration. I think with that you do encounter something that's a bit harder, a bit less tangible, but just as important. It's that sort of cultural connection with the landscape, whether it's through the narratives that used to exist, the sort of oral histories that were the means of identifying and positioning yourself as an individual within the landscape. I think that's lost, actually. Yeah,
I think it has been. I mean, I think I was only thinking the other day that, you know, the people who lived in those glens probably could have traced their connection with those places back through from generation to generation. You know, their parents would have been brought up in the same glen. Perhaps their grandparents were brought up there too, and so that connection with the landscape must have been pretty profound. Whereas I don't get that feeling now.
I totally agree, actually, and I think, I suppose one of the things I was thinking about the other day was this sense of folklore, and I guess what you're saying and where its place is now and how that's diminished. But then quite a sort of pleasing thought came to my mind, in the sense that oral histories have so less an importance now and prominence, you know, in the sort of digital age. But one of the things I was thinking about was where they do exist, actually, is probably in the outdoor community.
Yes, that's right.
Climbers and hill walkers, you know, a lot of the stuff that I I'm interested in and have based my writing on has been conversations I've had in pubs about, you know, whether it's the big grey man or you know, other sort of features of the landscape that are held onto by members of the outdoor community who will pass on to each other, and it kind of stays alive in this sort of word of mouth, which you don't often get in many other places these days. So, you know, that was quite a sort of pleasing thought for me, actually, that you do have this sort of vibrancy of sort of oral histories, but just in a different sense, I guess.
That's right. I think it's very true. I think it's declined a bit, but maybe there's a bit of a revival going on. I don't know, because one of the few places in fact where storytelling still exists is around a bothy fire, and that's why bothies perhaps attract me, and you know, those myths and legends. In fact, I think you told me you're reading Bothy Tales, and there's a story in there about I won't spoil it, but about a woman who burns a bothy down, you know.
Right,
that's loosely based on the truth. Very loosely, but I actually know the woman concerned. and she said it didn't happen like that. I said, yeah, but if I say it often enough, it will have. So I'm creating my own legend there, you know. So I think there's a very real sense in which maybe because the outdoor community feel connected in a way to the landscape to a slight degree from the way that the original inhabitants did. We are, after all, the only few people to be wandering those places. Maybe the stories that we bring back have got that kind of importance. So that's really what you're doing. In some ways, you're sort of through your book, through The Unremembered Places, you're sort of bringing people back into that connection with the landscape.
Yeah, I think so. And it's just, I mean, there's so many great stories there that relate to specific relics or ruins that, you know, we'll have the tendency to sort of walk past or just not look at. But, you know, taking the time to sort of visit some of these places, find out a little bit more about them, but actually just be there in person as well, I think it's a really powerful thing.
Okay, Patrick, maybe there's something, what really stands out to you when you were writing Unremembered Places? What sort of places really interested you?
I suppose one of the problems with writing the book was what to include and what to leave out. But one of the sort of most resonant places for me was one of the early chapters that I wrote about, and it was the Blackwater Reservoir, and that particularly held my interest because of a book that I'd read many years previously called Children of the Dead End by not necessarily an obscure author, but not a very well-known author, a chap called Patrick McGill, who had a really, really interesting backstory. And the novel itself is a sort of thinly veiled autobiography of his early life from childhood to becoming a navvy and working on the Blackwater Reservoir, which was a huge sort of civil engineering project at the turn of the 20th century. And there were, you know, upwards of 2,000 navvies in the glen above Kinlochleven. They built the town of Kinlochleven as well. And you know, there's a huge amount of industrial history in that part of the world. So it's a fascinating place to visit, but more so because of the story that's sort of intertwined in the pages of Patrick McGill's book, which I definitely recommend reading. It's very much written of its time, but it's a kind of fascinating story of his trials and kind of tribulations and referencing the landscape of the West Highlands as well. So it's really, really fascinating from that perspective.
Oh yeah, the navigators who constructed these places, I mean they basically had small villages, didn't they, where set up around them. It must have been quite an incredible place at the time, and really surreal when the dam was finished and all these guys just went. Must have been really strange, wasn't it? Must have been really strange leaving behind them these huge structures. Well, yeah, your book sounds really fascinating, but both the secret history of the Cairngorms and unremembered places there. And are you working on any more projects? What do you think you'll do in the future?
Yes, I am. Yeah. Having said I wouldn't write for a while, I probably started writing again shortly after the last one. So obviously a bit difficult at the moment because I can't do any physical research. But yeah, collecting together a few ideas. So hopefully be able to talk more about that in the next sort of year or so.
Yeah, well, yeah, no, when your next book's due to come out, I have to invite you on again. Well, this has been a real pleasure talking to you. And I'll put links to both of your books on the podcast page. And that's you and me. Hope that fairly soon we can get out and explore the wonderful islands that we've got. It's been fantastic talking to you. Thanks very much, Patrick.
Yeah, likewise, John. Thank you.
Well, thanks very much to Patrick Baker there. Big day here also for me. My fourth book, Wild Winter, is released today, or perhaps escaped is a better word. It's been a bit of a journey writing that book because I wrote it largely in lockdown, and the pandemic interrupted the explorations that I was hoping to have. But I think it's probably a better book because of that. So thanks very much to all the team at Vertebrate Publishing for their help with that book, and to Alex Roddy for being my trusted editor and mentor, I should say. So anyway, do pop along and get yourself a copy of Wild Winter, and I would really love to hear what you think of it. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.